This week's episode is a conversation I had with Puka G about their Storyteller Vault supplements, Tail Spinners about bardic magic, Bog Bodies about interesting creatures that kind of protect the gauntlet, and Book of Days, which is a compendium of holidays and a calendrical review of things that can be used in World of Darkness games. For executive producers, there's also a pre-conversation on the Patreon, and as a reminder, we will be taking off the weekend of Christmas and New Year's, and we'll be doing full episodes through January. And with that, on with the show.
Hi, Mage fans. This is your host, Terry Robinson with Mage the Podcast. And today, in person,
gasp,
in my living room, I am being joined by another consummate podcasting professional, Puka, from Changeling the Podcast. Puka, how you doing?
I'm feeling a little taken aback. I think that's the first time I've been described as either a professional or consummate in relation to a creative activity that I've been doing.
Alternatively, your co-host does a wonderful job of editing. I'm not sure how you divvy up those tasks, but
I'll take the fifth on that.
It is at least a de minimis mixture of you've done the homework, you've thought about it, you have something interesting to say, and it's at least periodically funny.
And we've cobbled together some intro music, which I think is like...
The intro music is pretty good. One of the things that's come up is like, should Mage the Podcast have intro music? And the thing it took me a while to realize is it can't be one genre. It would really need to be a blend of some sort. Like, there would need to be, to me, some mixture of a tambourine with some sort of faith practice music with like at least one semi-ironic guitar riff in it. But like if it were just like electronic or something, I'm like, no, that's not Mage. Like, yeah, I don't think any one sound could really do it. But you're one of the hosts of Changeling the Podcast. Before we get into your work in the Storyteller Vault, what is Changeling the Podcast, and why are you doing this to yourself?
Well, frankly, Terry, I hope you don't mind me saying, but it's your fault. So yeah, through Mage the Podcast, I connected with my co-host Josh, who we had semi-known each other many, many years ago, back in the wild days of the forums online, White Wolf and then Shadow in Essence. And I think what spoke to each of us about Mage the Podcast was that combination of developing really thorough knowledge about the canon of material, but then taking it a step further and thinking about its implications and all of the different permutations of it. And we were each like, oh, it'd be cool if Changeling had something like that. Because the Changeling fan base, I think, has always been a very dedicated one, but there's not much out there along those lines. And Josh had floated the idea on a couple of occasions in, I think, the Mage of the Podcast Discord. And I just reached out and said, hey, if you want some help, I'd be totally into that. And the rest, as they say, is history. I think that's our mission statement, if I can be so grandiose as to call it that, where there are a lot of new fans who have come in with C20. And C20, for all of its wonderfulness, by necessity has had to leave a lot out that is covered in the older books. Mm-hmm. So when we do one of these dives, people are like, oh, I had no idea that there was all of that material on House Liam or whatever. Gratifying. And as we have just completed our first season, yay, we are talking about ways to kind of, as Mage the Podcast has done, expand and talking about more general thematic things and tie-in stuff.
What would you say the goal is? So the one that you've said so far is to have new players know that there is a rich well of material. It can be hard to sift through, so we are going to help you with that. That seems to be one thing that the show does ably. How are you going to define the show as a success? Like, do you have any personal things that you kind of look at?
Something that I've teased for 2023 is that for the Storyteller's Vault, I would like to help more people out with developing their own homebrew content. And I think that's, to me, the sign of we're doing our job right. If people feel knowledgeable enough and inspired enough to create more for this game that is, let's say, on ice for the time being, from the official standpoint.
Yeah, not under active official development.
Yeah. And because that's where the new ideas are going to be coming up for the foreseeable future. Yeah. So generating enough interest and confidence in people in order to help maintain this game that we love.
Yeah. Mage got two official releases this year. We had 14 Storyteller Vault releases in 2022. And as you go through the year, the number increases. Mm-hmm. So for you, one of your things, little things that if you were to print out and save an email that said, hey, you made me realize that there is space in this game for my story, and I have created a Storyteller Vault supplement based on it. Mm-hmm. That would be like, that's your fist pump moment.
I'd frame it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Whenever I get a message that's like, hey, I'm going to run mage. I'm not entirely sure what I'm doing, but you've given me a sense that I could figure it out.
Yeah.
I'm like, let's do it. Let's effing do it. Yeah. That's kind of my sign.
But yeah. People have said that. I mean, on the Discord, people have said, you know, I never thought, oh, I'm going to do a module, but now I think I might. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I don't know that any of those have actually appeared yet, but it's great to see people engaging so passionately.
I would also like to get to the point where both you and I have done that either proofing review or what I'll call a development review, mm-hmm. where someone says, here's my idea, what do you think about it? And we kind of help someone develop it. I am both pleased that I have helped a few things come to fruition, as well as in one or two cases, I think saved people a lot of time mm-hmm. in saying it is not clear what you're even talking about. It is very obvious that you have an idea of what you think the mage world is, but from the M20 I don't see this fitting into that. So if you're going to do this, I think you're going to need to have more scaffolding and more of a framework to do that. And it is both useful to help someone get something over the finish line, as well as help someone determine if they start the race, are they going to be able to finish it? Mm-hmm. So I think both of those are very useful in turn. I would also love to see a program where it's like, just come up with good text and these people will help you turn it into a book.
Yeah.
Like the formatting and templating and getting it into an arted format that is also on the STV. It's one of those things where it's like, yeah, you can be a good RPG writer, but to succeed at this point, you also need to be good at a lot of other skills. Yeah,
absolutely.
Just because you talk good doesn't mean one can podcast. There's a bunch of other technical skills that kind of come into that.
The last year has absolutely been a trial by fire.
Yeah.
In that regard.
And I think it's a trial that you've come through admirably. So speaking of getting things under the Storyteller Vault, you have been a bit of a canon when it comes to getting these things out there. Why did you choose to start releasing things on the Storyteller Vault, especially now that you have a podcast and you could just do an extended episode or a pair of episodes or something on Bog Mummy, say?
So that question's easier to answer, I think. One is that I find it easier to type longer than to talk longer. And I also think, as someone, I basically never listen to audiobooks, for example. And I listen to very few podcasts, Mage the Podcast being one of the notable exceptions.
Thank you, Pook.
So, yeah. And I feel, I guess because I don't want to listen to those ideas all in one go, I want to give people the power to move through them in their own way, at their own pace. And I think text affords that more easily than skipping around in a audio file. What was the first part of the question?
Oh, why did you start doing STV Septimums?
I guess because I've always kind of done my own homebrew stuff from time to time. I remember in high school, one of the first things I did was coming up with C-based changelings, and then Blood Dim Tides dropped. And I was like, crap. So it's always been something I've liked to play around with. I always enjoy developing my own worlds when I'm running games rather than having to work around metaplot and all that other stuff. So I was running a mage game during lockdown, and over the course of developing the ideas for it, I was like, oh, I kind of wish there was more in M20 about this or about that. And it just became a process of taking those ideas and thinking, well, what could I actually spin into something other people might be interested in? Or what I hope they might be interested in. And then I think it was a conversation with friend of the show, Charles Siegel, that convinced me to actually give it a go.
Do you feel there's a through line through your work? Or are there elements of a book that you feel are kind of your imprint?
There is, I'll say this, there are, I like to put Easter eggs, there are little tiny connections in, so like one book, there's a hint about a forthcoming book that I have on my slate, and that I like to do frequently. So in that direct way, yes. Other than that, though, I suppose to use a quote that I think you've used on a couple of occasions, there is more in heaven and earth than is dreamt of in your philosophy, Horatio. That there's always ways to push out the boundaries and ways to complicate what's in the canon in innovative and individualistic ways.
There are frequently implications to the rules of the world that are not manifested. So the example I will use is when we don't get information on a craft being in an area. So we get a book of crafts. Is this implied to be the totality of the crafts? Or is this just a selection? Like, for instance, 1E has this weird discussion where it talks about the order of the nine mystic traditions are only some of the traditions, which kind of implies that there could be another group waging the Ascension War. And since in 1E, the Ascension War was so totalizing, mm-hmm. the idea of 2E crafts that are not taking place in it, that are just tending to culture or what have you, wasn't really there yet. So Adam looked at the early things and they're like, well, obviously there would be 3 or 4 additional traditions in Asia. We just don't have information on it yet. Whereas other people are like, oh, wait, there are no Asian traditions. This is like, obviously we would want word count on it, but still, what do we take from the implication? And yeah, your works suggest, yeah, there's nothing saying this thing couldn't. It doesn't depend on some weird quirk that only I have introduced. And the first one you introduce is a craft called the Talesingers in your supplement, Talesingers. Who are they and what's their deal?
So the Talesingers came out of a desire to have bards basically in Mage. And I know that you can make bards in different other parts of Mage, but I wanted just a craft of bards. Because at the same time that I was running a Mage game, I was playing a bard in a D&D game. And it was kind of a deep dive into that idea. So in my academic background, among other things, I've studied comparative literature. And one of the things that we talked about frequently was the development of written culture out of oral culture, the mythic threads, to use a game term, that kind of run parallel to each other in different cultures. And it just got me thinking about, well, what would it mean if the storytelling itself was your magic? It wasn't a means to an end. It wasn't, this is my instrument for doing whatever effect. It's just, this is magic. To tell a story and keep that story alive is a form of magic. And it just kind of grew out of that, thinking about how to make that thread manifest in different contexts around the world, in different cultures, etc. And I like the idea of itinerant mages. I think the majority of mage characters I've played have been wanderers of some kind. So leaning into that a little bit.
This is a pay what you want title. This was kind of early in your series. What kind of makes it a craft as opposed to it just being a practice?
I suppose because they see themselves as a unified group. And I remember when I was putting it together, I was sort of caught because I kind of said, well, they're not exactly a craft because they're not localized to a single part of the world, single culture, but they're also not big and diverse enough to be a tradition in my mind.
It does raise an interesting question. Like one thing popped up on the Mage Facebook group, and it was like, if there are going to be cross-tradition groups, what do you think would draw them together? And my statement was, I thought it would be more interesting to have practice groups to be like, well, like one of the easy ones are the Akashiana and the Euthanatoi both believe in some solely recurredness thing. And it is suggested that they periodically compare notes. But the idea of a verbena, a dream speaker memorialist, all kind of comparing notes, that to me is interesting. But at the same time, it's one of those things where it's like, do people talk in terms of practice? No, but I think they would recognize it. So I like the idea that the mage world is shot through with people who kind of do a family of related things using a family of related tools. It's kind of like one of those things where you go across the Eurasian steppe and it's like, oh, wow, your national dish is rife of vegetables, something vaguely sweet, and a meat of some sort. Oh yeah, that's completely different than your neighboring country's national dish, which is a rice with meat, a vegetable, and something vaguely sweet in it. These surely do not share a culinary ancestor of any sort. Your shaved meat sandwich on something that looks awfully like a pita is completely different than the shaved meat sandwich on. And one of the ideas in Mage is that mages kind of refuse to break that contrivance. They say that the satire is that people are all doing the same thing and they refuse to talk about it. And this says, well, what if people talked about it?
Yeah. I mean, probably they'd fight a lot less.
Who do you think should grab Talesingers?
Anyone who wants to run a bard in Mage.
Are there non-traditional incarnations of bardism that you think, well, it should really be this? Like my standard example is I think that Greek Stoics and the Akashiana should recognize each other kind of as kindred spirits. Like how do we reduce the karmic influence in the world around us? One does it for this kind of external purpose. One does it for this kind of internal purpose. But really, are there versions of bardism that are not just the Ren Faire guy with a lute?
Absolutely. So I think one of my favorite pieces of that book was, so it contains, among other things, a list of rotes. And one of them, I think it was called Eulogy, but it was the most powerful rote in the book. So it's the pinnacle of their magic. And it's a hefty spirit mind, whatever effect. But essentially what it does is takes a dying elder of whatever tradition tradition with a small t that the bard is working within, and turns them into a spirit and turns them into a figure, that an ancestor spirit that can be drawn upon later. And that to me is like, you know, we talk about bardism in the sense of drawing on mythic threads or drawing pieces of stories into reality, but the idea of creating a story as a form of strength that underlies an entire culture, that's something I wanted to get into.
There is an interpretation of bardism that I feel fundamentally gets it wrong, but I still find it fascinating, is the idea that, like, I think it was Neal Stephenson said that rhyme is checksums for culture, that in a certain way, bards are kind of mentat, that they have like, what do you do when you don't write anything down in your cult? You literally have to be able to take your heritage with you. We don't get to build the temple. So are there modern incarnations of bardism who are like, no, how far can we push this? How do I remember 30 generations or 300 generations? Or how do I memorize 10,000 spirit names entirely in song form? And I can't remember what group it is or where, but basically that's how they interact with Umbrood, that all of them have little musical motifs that they need to know and special names and phrases in a score languages. And I was always curious to see that as a modern interpretation. There is kind of a branch of hermetic magic, and it always didn't feel comfortable there, but basically the idea of what are the limits of human ability, and one of them to be, no, I am going to be, as it were, the apex bard. I will beat the virtual adept at computation, but using song, the mathematical powers of harmony, that is my calculation and tabulation tool. So there, I always like it when we can take a paradigm in kind of a weird direction.
Yeah. And it's very much, I think you always have to think about what's the point of it, because if the idea is I'm going to demonstrate my capabilities by memorizing X lines from whatever epic or whatever, that's part of it. But if the other part of it is I'm going to make my audience feel as inspired as I feel when I sing this, that's an entirely different skill set, which is still part of it. I feel like my religious knowledge is, I'm not sure if I'm going to get this right. Mm-hmm. In Islam, there's a tradition of the Hafiz, which is someone who has memorized the Quran. And if I am remembering correctly, part of that, it's not just memorizing the lines, it's also memorizing the pattern of notes when you sing it and the sort of melodies that come out of that. Because if you just recite it, yes, it may still be meaningful and important to people. But if you add that layer of like how you would hear it during the call to prayer, that adds an emotional dimension that really makes it stick. And I think that's why it's one of the most impressive achievements within that religious framework to be able to do that. I mean, it's a title of honor to be Hafiz. Something like that. And it's something which used to exist in a lot more cultures, but has fallen out in a lot of cases. There's a wonderful interview on YouTube from, it's like a documentary in the 80s, and they interview one of the last traditional Irish storytellers. And they're sitting with an interpreter who's kind of repeating the lines in English as he's going. And he keeps saying like, yeah, he's using words that there's just no, we don't really have a word for it. It's a word that's lost, but it's just, it's part of the text to create this atmosphere and this mood. You know, they're talking about a journey. He's throwing in these onomatopoeia that I don't have any translation for, but it gives you that sense of moving on the sea or whatever. So those little things, I think, are important to remember in what bardism is.
Polytropos.
Yeah, exactly.
Polytropos, I am using as a synecdoche. Emily Wilson is a translator who did a highly celebrated translation of the Odyssey. And the opening line is something to the tune of, let me tell you a tale of a blank man. And the word in Greek is polytropos. And it would literally mean poly, many, tropos, turn. Atropos, the fate of death. Atropos literally means that which cannot be turned away. Mm. So polytropos, how the dink do you translate it? And she goes over the history of how other translators handled it. And ultimately, she chose the term complicated.
Which I love.
Yeah. And it's one of those things where, yes, it is, when we refer to a term as untranslatable, I kind of push back on that slightly. I would say something like, it is not elegantly translatable, or there is no one for one.
Yeah.
But yeah, like you make mention of onomatopoetic words. We obviously can't communicate in that in English because we have comparatively few compared to other languages. And we also run into the problem of English doesn't rhyme nearly as well as a lot of other languages. So you kind of lose that cadence, but you try and you get there. And also it's one of those things where language will always be flawed because it's fundamentally a conversation that has cultural knowledge embedded in it. So it is always possible in the translation process, you actually make something more true, as it were, to the original, if you're able to use metaphors, similes, and so on that will better convey that. If you were to do another craft book, what do you think it would be?
because you've been doing the recent Sorcerer's Crusade dives, my favorite character that I ever played in Sorcerer's Crusade was inspired by the player from the play Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, okay. Masterfully performed by Richard Dreyfuss in the film version. Ooh. That idea of magic through thespianism, not just acting, thespianism, I kind of like as an idea. He has this great line in the play where he says, "We're actors, we're the opposite of people." And that to me is like the core of it. And I would kind of want to explore that a little bit, maybe.
Is that kind of an idea that to some extent we are the manes we put on, that there is a collection of identities we choose to don, and the actor is merely someone who realizes these can be worn lightly and transferred around?
Yeah, that a transformation is not necessarily irreversible or total. It's not any less real.
Yes.
So that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Another early publication of yours, which is not explicitly mage, is the World of Darkness publication, Bog Mummies. What the dink?
It started as a joke. Like, there's a throwaway line in one of the Mummy the Resurrection books, or maybe even like in Mummy Second Edition, where they say, oh, of course there could be mummies from other parts of the world. And it's just kind of left at that. Mm-hmm. And I've always found bog mummies to be a really interesting piece of history. I've seen a couple of them in museums in Ireland, and it's really creepy to see this like perfectly preserved skin with nothing inside of it, you know? And so I just thought, how would I fold these into Mummy the Resurrection? It was going to be just this short little book, and then it just kept growing and growing. And I thought, well, this is going to be its own standalone mini game now. The conceit behind it is essentially they're not creatures of the underworld, and they're not creatures come back from the dead. They are part of the gauntlet. They are manifestations of the gauntlet that join with, like in Mummy, recently dead mortals and walk around doing reinforcing the gauntlet things or manipulating the gauntlet things.
What does that mean?
So the backstory within the book of how they were created is that the spell of life in some corrupted form, the spell of life being the thing that initially gave the Egyptian mummies their animacy, was transferred probably through mage groups from mage to mage to mage back in the before times until it reached sort of settlements on the fringes of civilization. So bog bodies are very localized to environmental conditions in Northwestern Europe. I was thinking about in the prehistoric times, this notion of, oh, you have a village on the edge of the wilderness being harassed by spirits, by monsters, by ghosts, whatever. The elders coming together with this corrupted form of this spell in order to create a defender for themselves. And essentially it's like, there's the old tradition of immurement where if you're building a bridge or building a wall and burying someone alive to ensure that it stands. So it's that idea with the gauntlet. Some of them volunteered, some of them did not. And that's the two groups within the game. They were part of the gauntlet as like a, you know, sentinel or a caryatid holding it up for millennia until something happens that may or may not be called the sixth great maelstrom that dislodges them.
And how do I use this in a mage game? I mean, you use the term gauntlet, so that screams kind of mage to me.
Well, the term they use is rampart because it's the gauntlet and the shroud. It's the same thing to them, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, so I think they make for good antagonists.
Okay.
Because obviously if you have a mage whose whole thing is about going to the Umbra and their whole thing is you're not going to the Umbra, we're not letting that stuff in, that creates tension. But they're also, I always try to look at what every splat can teach the others, you know, philosophically or conceptually. And I think that depending on the bog body you meet, they can teach a thing or two about duty in the cosmic sense, the karmic sense, maybe dharmic sense, or about rebelling against it. I think that could be relevant to some mages.
So you make mention that they were kind of there as a defender, like the early Umbra was not safe for humanity. So these are creatures that as aides and allies may have intense knowledge about the local Umbra or penumbra. I like the fact that they themselves are not wraiths. They have stuck in that liminal area. And I like the metaphor of, I mean, a body being buried in peat. It's not that deep.
Yeah.
It's just, it is at the skin. It is liminal. And I do like the idea of, if you one didn't want to go this far, that there is a group of wraiths or something like that, or another type of spirits that kind of die in liminal spaces.
Yeah.
And this is kind of what they become. It also allows us to recast paradox spirits. I always like the idea that paradox spirits are either mages that have realized that they need to serve something, or or have been corrupted, or were a group of mortals that were the early ones to fight back against mages and died in paradox backlashes or something like that, or died in massive magical effects. So every time a Toftani uses the Gullet of Fire to kill someone, you've actually just created another paradox spirit that, like a mortal that dies directly due to vulgar magic, becomes this other thing. Do you consider them intrinsically of the Weaver or of Stasis?
To an extent, I think I put something in there where they essentially, from a mage perspective, always have a point of static resonance. Mm-hmm. They're self-aware of their own stasis and they're able to manipulate it as they need to, if that makes sense. It would be like a changeling deciding how much banality they're going to be using. You know, they know it's not good for them, but they can still flex it if they need to. So there's that. But they have things like just their presence raises the gauntlet by one. It's just one of their inherent things. So whether they like it or not, they do always still have this kind of ossifying effect on the stuff around them. They can trap spirits in place, you know, they can force them back across, all that kind of stuff.
I like the idea of that ossification being extended in other kind of useful directions. For instance, they can prevent someone from dying. You do not get to cross. You are going to be absolutely miserable and you'll be at zero health points until I leave.
I forget if I put that as a spell. I'm trying to like think back to the spell.
Yeah, or something like, oh, your effect, just thematically, they would have the minor sphere of cusp or something like that, that they prevent transitions in various ways. Anytime we can take the philosophical notion of something and kind of run with it. Are there enough rules to play one? And if so, what game do I play as?
Would be reanimated skin bag?
I was going to say as a dankness of bog mummies. I'm not sure what the collective noun is.
I like dankness. That works. So because Storyteller's
Vault. A swamp of mummies.
Because Storyteller's Vault has rules against creating new core systems, okay. I couldn't actually, you know, create from scratch. So you do need one of the other core rule books to play it. I think it jives best with Wraith or Mummy. I think you can use the mage rules as well, but much like Mummy the Resurrection, there's no complete rule set within the book itself. So you do need to kind of append it to one of the 20th anniversary editions. So technically it is a World of Darkness 20th anniversary edition.
So I make a bunch of Bob Mummies. What story do we play?
You could go in a bunch of directions. I think the most compelling ones would be to either be protecting a group of mortals from some foe, some cosmic force, some risen thing or whatever. Or I think they make good, not treasure hunters, knowledge hunters. And as mummies often do, there's that parallel with Mummy in the sense that they're not necessarily fighting for Mott. They don't have a balance rating and all this stuff, but they do have some level of investment in keeping bad things away from mortals and some level of investment in uncovering lost secrets. It was also an excuse to drop a quote from the By God 20 song, The Bog, in terms of dank goth dance tracks from the early 90s.
And you have lovely cover art of Tolland Man, which always makes me think of an Alphaville album cover. Kind of continuing on to one of the through lines to me seems to be culture is bigger than you think. And one of the things that makes me really think that is your compendium, I'll call it Book of Days. I believe in Storyteller Vault parlance, this is what's known as a chonk.
Yes.
Yeah, it strikes me as one of those projects where like, how big could it be? And then it became as big as it was. What is Book of Days?
So Book of Days, I had wanted, within Changeling the Dreaming, there are references to the calendar that the Fae keep. And a lot of it is drawn from traditional Irish, you know, the cross quarter days, the solstices, the equinoxes, and then other stuff like Pranksgiving and High Summer and all of these holidays. The Shadow Court book kind of dives deeply into each of them. And then the others are scattered through various supplements. And I just kind of wanted them all in one place. I was a little bit inspired actually by Charles's Enlightened Grimoire of doing that with rotes, and I wanted to do that for holidays. And I thought, well, I've already got dozens of them to start with. Why don't I just try to make it a year-long calendar of events? Mm-hmm. This turned out to be a lot more difficult than I expected because not all days are created equally in terms of how significant they are to cultures around the world. So there were days when I was just hunting through Wikipedia or whatever resource I could find to find like something in the world that was meaningful for like, I don't know, December 19th or whatever days, you know.
Does it cover all 366?
It does. As it were? Okay. It does. And I'm glad you said 66 because leap day is in there. So.
How does it deal with, for instance, cultures with a lunar or a lunisolar calendar or with movable feasts or what have you?
For holidays that are associated with calendars that are mobile but within relatively fixed points in time. So like the Chinese lunar calendar or lunisolar? Lunisolar calendar, I think, is Chinese. I did actually look into this when I was writing. The Chinese New Year, for example, always falls between two dates. And so I chose the middle date as kind of the reference point, but then put it in brackets.
Got it.
For something like Muslim holidays, which are continually kind of moving back through the Gregorian calendar, I basically included a note that says it'll be roughly in this spot for the next 5 years or so as of publication.
Does it include only real days, or do you make any up?
Oh yeah, there's plenty that are made.
Can you give us a couple that are important in Changeling, some human cultural days that maybe of note, and maybe one or two that you made up?
I mean, a lot of them are just, I would find this random little reference to a holiday and then think like, okay, well, what would the changelings do with that? And often it's what would a specific kith and or changelings in a specific place do with that? So like, for example, there's one holiday, the name of which I'm ashamed to say I can't remember, but it's from Bulgaria, and it's a feast to honor midwives. And so there's a society in Changeling, the Order of Eleftheria, and their whole thing is helping changelings through chrysalis. They're kind of the midwives of changelings. So I was like, oh, this would be a day when changelings give gifts to the fae that helped them through their chrysalis. And it's just little things like that, you know, because it's such a massive book. A lot of them are short descriptions, but then there's some long ones as well.
I could see that going in kind of two different directions. One, if it's a cultural holiday, I perfectly see any group that cares about birthing celebrating that. Mm-hmm. So to have the stereotypical verbena group or something that wants to celebrate it, or alternatively, we are Bulgarian hermetics.
Yes.
This is going to be part of our holiday, or we are a craft that is operating in it. We are a group of sorcerers. This is kind of important to us. And as well as kind of giving us an idea like what mage holidays exist. Mm. And we really only, off the top of my head, I only remember two. Horizon Stronghold of Hope gives us a few where it's like, this is Mage Day, where there's an annual celebration which basically marks the foundation of Horizon. There's a week of celebration, so on and so forth. There's a sword swallowing contest.
Oh, man.
Yeah, where magic is allowed, but not the wrong kind of magic or something like that. It's a book that tries real hard, and I appreciate that.
Could you use correspondence to somehow create an infinite sword and infinite swallowing?
So that it specifically says that is considered to be poor sportsmanship. Ugh. But the idea is you need to use matter and life to do it. So I'm like, oh, okay. So pattern sphere supremacy coming out. I don't know how I feel about that. The forces version of that could be interesting. Like, every sword just gets transferred into a blood curdling scream. But also, what kind of mage holidays? Like, is there Apprentice Day or something like that? Where like, is there the day where like all mages kind of send their mentors a greeting card that either says thank you or I'm coming for you? Both acceptable.
Yeah.
A reminder of outstanding thanks and a reminder of outstanding grudges. But also, yeah. These are probably things that are going to be, in mage parlance, junctures, times. Absolutely. When quintessence can be collected.
Which is an idea. So in the old Changeling second edition book, Dreams and Nightmares, there are a few references to how on certain holidays, if you go collect certain types of dream stuff from the dreaming, it'll be more potent. And so I kind of tried to run with that idea and said like, well, yeah, obviously if you use certain types of magic on certain days, it's going to be a little more potent, which is also something from Pendragon, but that's a whole separate thing. If you're doing necromancy on Samhain, of course it's going to be more powerful because that's just, it's in the air, you know. I think mage would benefit from drawing a lot more on the mythic threads idea, which is so intrinsic to Changeling. That would be one example.
I always wish that there was another publication that I was working on that was basically a doctrinaire statistic, which is the idea of how open or closed are you to other magical ideas and what are the benefits of it. Yeah. If you are very close to other magical ideas, you are very potent. You should be in what you're doing. For instance, you should be able to use a rote that is a dot level above what you have if it is intensely tied with your people. And suddenly this can explain phenomenon whereby like, this is a 5-dot effect. How have they been able to do it for 10 centuries? Well, because of this rule, you actually only need to be an adept.
Yeah.
To pull this thing off. And the opposite end of the spectrum is you see all magic as one magic, but at the same time, then nothing is kind of special. One of the advantages of kind of being doctrinaire is if a effect were appropriate, it would be a type of vulgar. You would still get paradox, but it would be successful. It would allow you to kind of take that on, where if you were doing an appropriate effect with the appropriate people surrounding you, if not everyone is in on it, but the setting seems to be appropriate and you are fulfilling the appropriate role, it would almost be this kind of blatancy where you can get away with it because your belief pushes out the part that would cause it to fail, but not quite all of paradox.
Almost like sphere limits are part of consensus. You're like forcing. Yeah, I like that.
And you still deal with the problem of meta magic becoming, well, my paradigm is I'm awesome at everything all the time.
I'll usually let players, if it's cinematic enough and it makes sense in the context of a scene and they're just one dot short, I'm like, yeah, it's fine. It might be increased difficulty. You might need more successes, but yeah, that's fine.
And the trick it runs into is I really want Mage the Awakening to have the idea that paradox is caused by you being messy in your reach. I try to avoid that, even though it's a really interesting kind of interpretation of things. Are there any other uses you see for the Book of Days, or alternatively, what were some of the holidays that you made up?
Well, and a lot of them weren't necessarily days that I made up, but just I would find something like, on this day in history, this happened. It's like, perfect, let's make a holiday around that. The only one that I kind of, as a bit of a wink, kind of made up out of whole cloth was, I think for June 30th, I made it a day where reality seems to fracture slightly. And this was in relation to both the Tunguska event, because why not?
Yeah.
But then also to the Week of Nightmares, which has been, I'm not even sure if it's been retconned. Can we say it's been retconned? Semi-retconned? But that's, you know, that was like June 30th, July 1st. So I'm like, you know, the changelings know something happened on this day somehow, but nobody can point to exactly what it was, because it has been retconned in Changeling. Reality seems to blur at the edges on that day. Something for Mage, maybe.
I was trying to figure out a month that didn't have a 31st day in it, and I was curious if you had like an entry for like April 31st or something. I don't actually know which months have how many days except for February, so there is no June 31st.
Correct. Right?
Yes. So I was curious if you...
I think there's something in programming where you can... I think there's like a specific date that's used as like a dummy date or something, but that would be a more virtual adept thing, I would imagine. So if you have sufficient time, you can get to that date and do all kinds of weird stuff on that day, which doesn't exist.
It looks like we have a one. It's just kind of a compendium of interesting things from a cultural point of view, and that is always useful. You also did another publication about an interesting group in Changeling that I think actually have a bunch of interesting ties to Mage if one wishes to create them in the form of Kithbook Gidu or Gilidu, or you will now do the actual pronunciation.
Gilidu?
Yeah.
Yeah, however you want to do it is.
What are they and what's kind of their deal?
They were a Kith introduced in Isle of the Mighty, the Changeling Mage crossover book about Britain.
Please note that when we say crossover, there's implied air quotes there.
Yes. They are the green men. They are the stewards of humanity's relationship with nature, is the way that I like to frame it. So they're not the inanime, who are the spirits of nature, and they're not like the spirits of farm labor or like, you know, the sort of domestic spirits. They're kind of at this in-between point. In the sort of historical sense, the way I see them is they might be the ones who, just before humanity developed agriculture, they were the ones that you would make offerings to or pray to or relate to in order to ensure the crops were growing. Mm-hmm. That notion that something is in control and it's not us yet, those dreams.
Semi-agricultural is a thing. Mm-hmm. It is not uncommon that a culture or a people would be like, we haven't quite domesticated anything yet, but we figured out that this seed will produce more of this tree. So we're going to put a bunch in this area and we're going to go do our migratory thing. And hopefully next year, there are slightly more apples or pomegranates or bananas or whatever in this area. And it's kind of semi-agricultural. So.
And it ties into this notion that floats up occasionally in Changeling that agriculture and the idea of taking control over nature was one of the first major sources of banality. They're just before that. And they're one of their first waves of banality was humans saying, no, we don't need you anymore. We'll grow our own wheat.
There was a book I was reading that was basically on kind of the progression of belief in terms of what is the succession of beliefs a culture goes through as they kind of gain dominion, where you kind of go from this phase where there are gods everywhere, the world of supernatural and unknowing to one where you just get a notion of, no, 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 we have more control than we think. And then magic starts to enter a culture. And then as dominion expands, you usually get slightly more hierarchical leadership structures. And then what we would recognize more as a religion with doctrines comes into play. And then there is some sort of magical purge that occurs. And then notionally you get to an age of reason or enlightenment or what have you before. And again, you can move back and forth between these. And that was one of those things where it's like, this person has obviously done a lot of reading. I could in no way back up or dispute their claim.
Yeah.
But it seems neat. How do they fit into the world of Changeling?
Very clumsily at first. The reason why I started doing it, this actually started on the Shadow and Essence forums back in 2005 or 6, this project. In a sense, I've been working on it, or I was working on it for something like 14 years. But one of the issues people had with them, so in Changeling, as you accrue banality, you start to, you know, fall more and more away from your fairy identity. And their thing was, as they would kind of, I won't get into the Changeling terms, but if they got a major hit of banality, they would advance into their next stage of life, of which they had three: spring, summer, and autumn. If they hit winter, they're dead. In the old rules, it was very difficult to sustain them as characters for long. I added new mechanics to make them a little bit more playable, but then also in terms of their place in the ecosystem of Changeling, they're the ones that have the wisdom about what it means to move through those life cycles, which all Changelings must, just generally on a longer time scale. And they're the ones who have the most knowledge about reincarnation, because some of them do it every year with the seasons. Okay. And so it's an area of Changeling lore and Changeling culture that I didn't feel had enough being talked about it. So that was one of the things that I wanted to get in there.
Do they have people on the opposite end that stay in a particular season for centuries?
Yes, but they go quite mad.
I very much like that, as you have the hermetic master who has stayed beyond even the far horizon and is 6 centuries old. And then you have maybe a Kosian who feels comfortable extending human life to like 150 years to like whatever they consider to be the maximum of the Hayflick limit. And then you have other people who are like, this is unnatural. You get your 3 score in 10,
yeah,
or something like that. A character that believes in kind of reincarnation being like, oh, well, here's someone who has something figured out. Kind of like the Euthanatos Tui note of mummies, are they master riders of the wheel or are they abominations upon it?
This is a bit of a tangent, but whenever there are these longevity claims that kind of pop up periodically around mm-hmm. the world, I always love when there's no way to prove or disprove the claims short of, I don't know, the medical, you know, measuring someone's bone density or the mm-hmm. telomeres or whatever. But if there's this old woman who's like, oh yeah, I'm 140. And everyone in the village is, oh yeah, she's 140. And there's only documentation going back 70 years.
Yeah.
And she was alive. It's that fuzziness of reality that Mage is so good at. So
I do like the idea in Mage that, like, in the modern world, 250 is all you get, or something like that. Something ridiculous, yeah, to us, but still,
yeah,
nothing compared to what it was in the past. That you can go beyond that, but you really need to become something else.
You need to move to Neptune with Hermetic Master so-and-so.
And part of that deal is you need to make an agreement with the Incarna of Neptune. You are now a Neptunian who happens to have human characteristics.
What's Neptune's sphere association in the?
Yeah, it's mind or time or,
yeah,
shard realm.
I think Saturn is
Neptune.
Time.
Neptune, mind.
Okay, so you have to become a being of pure thought or something.
Yeah,
so,
yeah. And I kind of wish, publication I've also kind of dabbled on, are Archmaster and Ascension are kind of two boring options.
Mm.
What are other ways we can tie our patterns up with things? And one of the thoughts is, so you have these exemplars who tie their pattern to a sphere. Nice work if you can get it. Gods who tie their patterns up with a story or something like that. But what if you tie your pattern up with a place or something like that? And you just kind of become the genius of a locale, almost literally in the Greek sense.
I played in a game many years ago where it was over the course of years, but my character's arc culminated in becoming space-time for the next incarnation of the universe, mm-hmm. which I always thought was pretty cool. Becoming a law of nature.
Are they tied to a place? Do they get to move around?
They can. Okay. I think a lot of them stay in one place, partially by necessity, partially out of comfort. They don't like going into cities. I mean, because banality is still, I would say, more poisonous to them than to most other changelings. But they're foresters, and they're naturalists, and they're wise folk living on, you know, hermits, mm-hmm. living at the edge of town. And so that role, again, it's not necessarily conducive to romping through, fighting dragons, doing, you know, running through court and all that stuff, but it lends itself to a more meditative experience of the game, I think. So.
And I also like the reflection of like any nature-attuned character being like, I have a relationship with nature, and a Gidu being like, hold my beer.
Yeah.
Or something
yeah.
like that.
It's like, oh, you do.
Go one on.
Of the, I mean, one the of
Willy the Willy Wonka meme of go on about how you understand nature.
One of the frustrating things, I mean, I'm glad they did it, but with C20, they introduced the seasonal arts. So mm-hmm. in addition to chicanery and legerdemain, you have spring, summer, autumn, winter. Obviously, they're very skilled at using them. I had actually developed like my own version of those back in 2005. So when I had the C20 adaptation, I was like, oh, gotta rework all this stuff. It's nice to see those concepts kind of given more space in C20 because that gives them more ground to stand on, mechanically speaking.
Last, but certainly not least, is the Book of Fragments. What is the Book of Fragments and why?
Again, spinning off of a throwaway section from an old mage book, in the revised Storyteller's Handbook, which is still one of my favorite mage supplements of all
time. Oh,
yeah.
It does a lot. Yeah.
It is a heavy lifter. But they introduce the idea of minor spheres, which are spheres that cut across the major nine around a specific concept. They have depth but not breadth in terms of, I don't know, whatever. The quintessential example of it being fire. So if you have fire as a sphere, you can start fires, control fires, light fires, which is the purview of forces. Mm-hmm. You can inspire people, make people passionate, etc., which is the purview of mind. You can create divine light and energy and stuff, which is the purview of prime. So it takes pieces from each of those.
You can summon a fire elemental or something like that.
Those are the four main things.
Ports. Yeah.
Yeah. So it cuts across the majors, but like you couldn't use the spiritual aspect of fire to summon a water spirit. It just wouldn't be allowed. It's thinking about spheres in a cross-cutting direction, orthogonally thinking about them, I guess. So yeah, so there was like a single half-page write-up in the Storyteller's Handbook, and I wanted to explore more of that.
And which ones do you go into?
So the nine in the book are, let me see if I can do this all at once, Desire, Emergence, Fire, Harmony, Glory. I was trying to go alphabetically. Hearth, Metamorphosis, Meaning, Night. Is that nine? Desire, Emergence, Fire, Glory, Harmony, Hearth, Meaning, Metamorphosis, Night. I will tease that there are nine more that I have on a list waiting to be made.
Dun, dun, dun!
So, someday.
And who do you think should be using minor spheres?
I think a lot of people, just from my kind of lurking on mage community stuff, such as in the podcast Discord, because people are so... Half of mage seems to be arguing about sphere potential. What spheres cover what can be pushed in what direction. A lot of times it seems to me that people coming from other game systems want something a little more siloed around concepts to work with, especially if their character is siloed around that concept. So if someone says, I want to play a pyromancer, mm-hmm. it's like, well, okay, you might need a little bit of forces, but also you need a little bit of prime. You might want some of this, some of that. And it can be hard to see the trees for the forest, I guess mm-hmm. is how I want to invert that metaphor. So I think it offers an alternative to go in that direction if people want.
It's also sometimes the thing that crosscuts requires a very high level of something, and you're just kind of looking for a narrow interpretation mm-hmm. of it. So like, for instance, Summon the Fury of the Sun is something that is frequently listed as like forces for, correspondence for.
Yep.
And that seems like a lot, as opposed to if someone is truly a priest of Aten, it really seems like that's just kind of a Sun 3
yeah.
thing. Likewise, there are certain things in the game that are just kind of hard for everyone. So I like the idea that there is a group out there that has the minor sphere of Soulcraft or something yeah. like that. And they are this fellowship that you go to whenever you need to brand or censure someone. And they kind of have that, kind of in the same way that, from my understanding, there were certain rare arts in Changeling, at least in previous editions, that were only known by certain people or were yeah. only developed by a certain group or something like that. So it's one of those things where it's like other people can do it, but it's really hard and it's at the fringes of their paradigm.
Yeah.
Like one argument you could make is properly played paradigms, all spheres are minor spheres, in that you have a subset of what the true sphere can do, but it is taken through the lens of your paradigm. I also think this is the natural home for like crafts.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, is it the Kopalue where there's the note in M20, like they don't believe in spheres? It's like, well, then what do they do?
What the ding do they do? Yeah. And kind of one of the things, having done so many darn one shots, when I look at a group and I'm like, oh, they don't have access to these spheres, I'm like, so I don't care. I mean, almost all of my games, like when I run between one and four sessions, no one has ever hit six different spheres. So even the limitations on the Hemka Sobek are kind of trivial. And also kind of having a minor sphere, I think, very much clarifies the relationship between paradigm, practice, and instrument. Mm-hmm. It makes that line a lot straighter, for lack of a better term. You, having produced nine of these, yeah, have now produced 90% of the enumerated minor spheres up until Charles Siegel's, yes, work on, I think, foreign magics
yeah,
using minor spheres to represent kin, mm-hmm, and kithfolk and so on. What did you find hard about writing them up, or what did you find easy?
I just kept having ideas of putting more stuff in, and I'm like, no, this is the exact thing I'm trying to work against. I mean, a lot of this was developed in conversations with other mage players. Mm-hmm. When I was developing my take on fire, people are saying, well, but you could interpret fire to mean, what if you burn away, you know, burn your way through reality? Isn't that correspondence? I'm like, oh. So the way that I tried to get out of that was, all of these are my templates for those spheres. Mm-hmm. And a significant portion of the book is dedicated to, here's how you can spin it into your own thing. Mm-hmm. So to say fire in the write-up I have is forces prime, mind, and spirit, that's one possibility for fire. You could easily have a fire that's correspondence, entropy, life, and matter.
And the can't you burn through distance, that is also an interpretation where it's like, that is the paradigmatic explanation of how your pyromancer uses correspondence.
Right.
Which is kind of useful. Were there any where you just, it couldn't come together? Invisible Sun, Take a Drink has all of the fortes that are listed within the game, which give you your interesting little paths. Mm. And sometimes they're very low level and they're very high level abilities. You're like, that's an interpretation of that idea.
Yeah.
Were there any where you're just like, oh man, kind of got left on the cutting room floor, as it were, because you couldn't completely populate it?
One of the things that I was glad that I included is, near the end, there's a little sidebar on allotropes. And okay, I say, like, that's what the Aetherites call them, but no one else uses that term. Where it's for each of the minor spheres, it's like, here's one option for if you swapped out this for this, what it would look like instead. So for emergence, the one that it like pained me to cut out was mind. Because I was like, I love the idea of you can spawn an AI with this sphere. So that's like one of the variations. It's like, if you want, you give up the notion of causing evolution in a living being, and instead you gain the power to eventually create an AI. But I did think it was important to limit it to like maximum four spheres that it connects to.
Okay.
Because otherwise then it just starts growing and growing and becoming a major sphere, which frankly, mage doesn't need more major spheres,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, and there is the interpretation of kind of minor spheres to me always read kind of as a slightly fuzzy list of rotes, where you're, yeah, like, I take this from the sphere, kind of mapping it. So you take a level one ability from one sphere and then a level two from another, yeah, and then kind of roll your own, but you have the additional requirement of it needing to have this additional inflection for it.
Some of the effects for each minor sphere are absolutely just repurposed rotes.
Yeah.
So,
and that certainly gets you there. So we've talked about a number of your publications. With this many under your belt, were there any that did particularly well or particularly poorly compared to what you thought? Or alternatively, is there anything that you wish got more love?
I'd like Bog Bodies to get more love, I have to say. I think Bog Bodies is the one that has sold the least on the Storyteller's Vault. But I understand why, because it's not like, you know, it's its own thing. So it doesn't slot neatly into a pre-existing whatever. But I do think, I mean, Book of Fragments, I think, is the best-selling one. And that shows me that it does fill a need that people were feeling. And that's nice to feel.
I do feel that, like, Bog Bodies, Guardians of the Gauntlet, or something like that, and just to be like, put the purple around the edge, I feel like would instantly, because I didn't know what it was until you had described it. And part of my fidgeting was me attempting to log into my Storytellers Vault account to grab it, because I think there should be just kind of more spirits out there. One of the other projects I've thought about is, what would make good nemeses based on the different points of the metaphysical trinity? One of the ideas I had was, what if quiet was something that could happen to anyone, which it is? So the Marauders are no longer a faction. It's just kind of an end state that periodically happens. In the same way that in Vampire, what is it, being a white or a right or whatever it is, when you reach humanity zero?
Yeah.
That's not a faction in it. So what if the Marauders were just a thing that happened to people, and they tend to be rather short-lived and don't really have any formal structure whatsoever? The Technocracy is the balance group, and the Mage are the the dynamic group, what other interesting nemeses could we get for the other points of the metaphysical trinity? Because I've never really liked the Nafandi representing primordial in that rough mapping. So
I've never really liked the Nafandi period.
Yeah.
It's a mood.
Yeah.
But I like that idea because, I mean, Werewolf has individual books dedicated to those. So should Mage. Book of dynamism, book of stasis, book of entropy.
I do like the idea that like you have the metatextual truth of each one that it, at the end of like the book of dynamism, it just kind of goes into a slur of letters. The book of entropy just ends kind of in
pages torn out.
Yeah. And the book of stasis just winds up having some red rum or like all work and no play statement that kind of fades out over the end.
Or it could be a circular text like Finnegan's Wake. You have to go back to the beginning and just keep going forever.
That is a generous interpretation, in my opinion, of Finnegan's Wake, but that's me. So we've talked about a lot of your works. Any words of advice or recommendations for people who want to jump into the Storyteller Vault, or alternatively, a thing that you would like to see exist that you don't think you can do?
To the first part, ask for help. People are almost always willing to give at least a little bit, and you need it. Even if you don't think you do, you will need help. It will also take you more time than you think it will. I would say don't be afraid to develop skills you never thought you would need. I think I've become much better at doing layout and doing kind of art cobbling as a result of, because it is fundamentally, I enjoy it because it's a creative process. It exercises my creative urge, and that's why I dump, frankly, probably more time than I should into some of these things. In terms of things that I would like to see that I don't think I'd be capable of doing, for Mage at least, I hope to see a standard rules document one of these days. That would be great. But also, I think, and this is a conversation that I've seen come up on Discord often, seeing introductory modules and adventures. I'd like to try one, but I think I'd probably have to do a lot more work to make it function than people who are much more seasoned at running Mage games. So those are the two big ones that I think the community as a whole would really benefit from.
The key thing I've learned is you get to do it more than once.
Yeah.
There seem to be a lot of people that really want to do a magnus opus of some sort, and that just seems to be not a great way to look at it.
Because you're always going to have more ideas.
Yeah.
So.
And it is very much made it clear to me that ideas are the cheap part.
Yes.
They're the easy one. It is very easy to think of an idea. It's relatively easy to come up with a 2-page outline. Mm-hmm. It is hard to get it across the finish line. And I wonder if there is a market for those 2-page outlines. And
yeah.
I'd be curious. Travis Legge always said that, like, yeah, you can just produce something that you wrote up in Word as long as it's obvious that that's what it is.
Yeah.
And I'm curious to see if there's any sort of market for that, but not an experiment I just haven't run yet.
I think Dungeons & Dragons does that a lot more in the sense that people make just 1-page splat write-ups essentially for D&D. And for whatever reason, it seems like people are less willing to polish those for World of Darkness games.
Mm. Puka, thank you so much for your time. If we're interested in following any future STV works of yours or Changeling the Podcast, how can we do it?
Well, Changeling the Podcast you can find at changelingthepodcast.com. I'm not going to go through our whole social media thing, but both the podcast and myself are on Mastodon. The podcast is changelingpod at dice.camp, and I am Puka Gar, G-A-R, at dice.camp. I've given up on the Bluebird site for now. You can find me around Discord. I'm on Storyteller's Vault. I have my little author page, so I think I have an email linked in there somewhere. But pukagar@gmail.com is also a possible way.
Puka, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
This has been Mage the Podcast, where we never forget to thank Ricardo for like a month in a row for being the executive producer, except for we did. Sorry, Ricardo. If you aren't hearing your name at the end of the show and you're supporting us at least a $3 level, give me a poke and I will add you back in, my bad. This episode was made possible by Ben Bendelow, Oracle of Hogbodies, the book of Hellpig Shapeshifters we never got. Buck Gregory, Oracle of Cogbodies, an early term for hit marks. Christopher Phillips, Oracle of Logbodies, what happens when Jewish verbena decide to make a different kind of golem. Guy Stewart, Oracle of Blogbodies, tulpas created by popular internet posts. Jay Widener, Oracle of Grogbodies, the loss of coordination that occurs after far too much rum. Josh Hillerup, Jogbodies, a mundane version of Better Body, where you just try and get outside more. Mikhail, Oracle of Clogbodies, ambulatory excrement spirits. Puka G, Oracle of Frogbodies, a derogatory term for amphibious changeling. Sean Gallagher, Oracle of Scrogbodies, the manifestation of bush spirits. The crew of Erebus, Oracle of Smogbodies, worm spirits that promote purchasing overly large trucks. Also thanks to Archmaster Andrew Adelstein, Archmaster Rad of the Blue, Archmaster Dan Svensson, Archmaster Derek Simsek, Archmaster Leroy Bryce, Archmaster Morgan Aran, Archmaster Nathan Weaver, Alex, Alexia, Ambiversion, Anders S., Anon, Bedurfi, Birdo, Blaze Hibbert, Blake Ryan, Brandon, Bryce Perry, Bubba the Pale One, Chris Blake, Sin Shotis, Daniel Cuppen, Damon Scribner, Darren Hennessy, David Roy, Dennis Osborne, Eli Levenger, Eric Schwenk, Fragorock, Friedrich Owl, George Laura, Henry Kraft, Ia Bolt, Jason Kennedy, Jason Vines, Jason W. Brake, J. E. Gatsby, Jeff Brin, Jenna F., Jervis Johnson, John Magnuson, Joel and Andy's, Lols and Stuff, Joshua Heath, Kathleen Halperin, Chris Kinner, Leslie Weatherstone, Matthew Prohl, Michael Creedle, Michael Parker, Nibero, Neil Patterson, Nikita Klamenov, Oliver Schindler, Patrick McNamara, Patrick Mulder, Rachel Grace, Ricardo, Richard Bat Brewster, Robart the Robot, Ruben Joseph, Ryan Stray, Rob H., Ryan Kendi, Samuel Tobin, Starfish, Stephen Carton, Thrice Great, Vincent Hamilton, Walter, William Conley, and William Martin. Our EP shout-out this episode is to Ambiversion, who I assume sometimes enjoys spending time with people and sometimes not. Signs you may be Ambiversion. I can perform tasks alone or in group. I don't have much of a preference either way. Social settings don't make me uncomfortable, but I tire of being around people for too much. Being in the center of attention is fun, but I don't like it to last. Some people think I'm quiet, while others think I'm highly social. I don't always need to be moving, but too much time down makes me feel boring. I can get lost in my own thoughts just as easily as I can lose myself in conversation. Small talk doesn't make me uncomfortable, but it can get boring. And of course, you support Mates the Podcast. Thank you so much, Ambiversion. Rather listen on YouTube, search Mates the Podcast on YouTube to find our full library there. If you super liked this episode or super didn't, drop us a line at matesthepodcast@gmail.com or at matesthepodcast on Twitter. We have a Hopin Discord community at discord.me/matesthepodcast. Mates the Podcast is also on Mastodon at dice.camp/@matesthepodcast. If you like us, please give us a review on the platform of your choosing or tell a friend about us. Also go to matesthepodcast.com for show notes and all of our previous shows. Now go change reality. Bye.